From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's what Peru has to do with you right now, or not. There's a bunch of world leaders who have been meeting there in Lima, Peru, the past 2 weeks. They're still there, trying to agree on a formula for reducing the amounts of carbon pouring into the atmosphere. And frankly, they're having a pretty hard time coming up with a deal. Which leaves you where, if you're somebody who cares and just wants to do your own part in your own way to cut back on your own output of, well, trash? A question that may be even more timely now at the time of year when, with the holidays, we are going to be producing a lot more trash than during the rest of the year. Well, get ready for some practical advice, and some you may not have heard before. This hour, On Point, being green for the holidays and beyond. You can join us on air or online. Do you aspire to a greener lifestyle? And do you even know where to start, or does it all feel so overwhelming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Lauren Singer. She is a 23-year-old who has lived a zero-waste life for the last 2 years. Zero waste, producing almost no trash. She runs a blog about this. It's called Trash is for Tossers, in which she documents how she does it. She recently quit her job as a sustainability manager for the New York City Department of Environmental Protection to co-found The Simple Co. Co is for company, which makes three-ingredient environmental laundry detergents. And if you want to see some images from Lauren's zero-waste life, including what the inside of her plastics-free refrigerator looks like, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Lauren Singer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. And how zero is your zero? How much are you truly not producing any trash in your life now?
For the past 2 years, I haven't sent anything to landfill. There have been little pieces of things. For instance, you know, those little annoying tags when you buy an article of clothing, those plastic things that connect the tag to the clothing, things like that. Mm-hmm. I actually keep those in a mason jar that's a 16-ounce mason jar in my home.
So even those are not hitting the landfill?
Correct.
So what was your inspiration for this? All your life or a late-in-life discovery?
You know, I've always been really passionate about sustainability and the environment. I studied environmental studies at NYU. I was a big activist around hydrofracking and the fossil fuel industry, and it all kind of started at NYU my senior year. I was in my capstone course. It's an environmental studies course that's the culminating course for my major. Every environmental studies student has to take it. And there was a girl in there that every day for dinner, she would bring in a plastic bag that had this plastic clamshell full of food, a plastic fork and knife, a plastic bottle of drink. And I would watch her night after night just toss it into the trash. And I would get so frustrated. And this happened a bunch. And one time after class, I was feeling particularly frustrated. And I went home to make dinner. And I opened my fridge and kind of had this moment where I froze. And I saw that everything that I had in there was packaged in plastic. And I felt like a complete hypocrite. You know, me, I was this sustainability girl. I had, you know, loved sustainability, talked about sustainability. It was my life. And here I was, you know, doing something that was in direct contradiction with how I wanted to live. So I decided in that moment to quit plastic. And quitting plastic meant doing things like learning how to make a lot of my own products that were traditionally packaged in plastic, like toothpaste or deodorant. And while I was learning how to make those things and researching recipes, I stumbled across this blog called The Zero Waste Home, started by a woman named Bea Johnson, who's a wife and mother of two children out in California who lives a zero waste life. And I figured, you know, if she can do it, I, as a 21-year-old single girl living in New York City, can do it. And here I am 2 years later.
So let's talk a little bit about plastic, because a lot of people will, I'm sure, invest in plastic as a storage. You know, people who want to be sustainable will actually invest in plastic with the idea, I'm going to keep these things forever. Mm-hmm. And you know, state the obvious for us. What is wrong with plastic? What was wrong with those plastic containers in your refrigerator?
You know, a lot of people say that plastic is just a problem because nothing wants to eat it. There's no real way to break it down. And there's also a lot of controversy surrounding plastic. You know, it leaches chemicals. It's toxic for the environment. It never truly biodegrades. And being trained as an environmental studies student, we learn to use the precautionary principle, which essentially says if there's controversy around something, you don't participate in it. And so that's kind of how I feel about plastic. So I feel like there are better, safer alternatives to plastic, like stainless steel and glass, that I feel more comfortable using.
So you went through a list of some of the things that you found were involved plastic that you wanted to get out of your life. So let's go back and a little bit more slowly and look at some of it. Sounds like a lot of it is about packaging. For example,
sure.
Shampoo comes in a plastic bottle. Toothpaste comes in a plastic tube. Juice can come in a plastic cup. What were some of the more challenging adjustments to make to remove those these containers from your life so that you could still have the stuff that was inside them?
I mean, besides the fact that there was definitely a learning curve in learning how to make all of my own products, so figuring out the recipes for my products, there were certain things that, weren't obvious to me. For instance, a disposable razor, something that I had and have grown up using. I wasn't sure how to deal with finding an alternative to that. What I ended up doing was finding a stainless steel safety razor, one that typically men use, and that's what I use instead of a disposable plastic razor. But things like that, were difficult because they weren't obvious to me. I had to do a lot of research. But it turns out that there's pretty much sustainable alternatives for every plastic product out there.
And what happens to the food that you don't eat or the parts of the food that you don't eat? Say you eat a banana, what happens to the banana peel?
I compost all of the organic waste that I don't use. So basically, if I eat a banana, I have a bowl in my freezer that I'll put the banana peel in. And once per week, every Saturday, I bring my compost and food scraps to the farmer's market where we have, a city composting program. And it's turned into a nutrient-rich fertilizer or topsoil.
And how heavy a bag of compost is that you carry through the streets of New York?
I'm just one person, so I'd say, it's 3 pounds or so.
That's all.
2-3 pounds.
When you're out and about, let's say you're eating in a restaurant, where does the world outside of your apartment where you can control things, where does it trip up your effort?
Restaurants is something that people ask me about a lot, and I always like to say that I can only control the trash that I create. Of course, I can't go to a restaurant and say, don't use any, plastic packaged food when you're making my dinner. But what I can control is saying to the restaurant, I'll order a drink, but could you please serve it to me without a straw?
Mm-hmm.
Or if they have a disposable napkin that they have or that they use as opposed to a washable napkin, I'll take that home with me and compost it. So the things that I can control, I do. But restaurants will produce waste.
Well, that sounds like most restaurants, I think, would be pretty accommodating, and they save a tiny, tiny fraction of a cent on the straw. So it sounds as though that part is pretty easy to integrate into your life. Is there socially, are there any challenges to this in terms of, I don't know, if you have friends over or if you're at friends' houses, how do you, continue to execute this plan without, annoyingly preaching to everyone around you, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I never preach about the way that I live. I feel like it goes against, no one wants to listen to someone who's preaching to them.
Right.
So I feel like the best thing for me to do is just live my lifestyle. And if people like it, maybe they'll adopt some of it or they'll be interested in it, ask me questions, but maybe I'm just really lucky. I have incredibly supportive friends, and I've hosted zero waste dinner parties that they have been so into. My family is incredibly supportive of my lifestyle. My dad the other day, when I was upstate visiting him, pulled me over to his garbage can and was bragging to me about how much he's reduced his waste in the past couple of months, which is something that I never asked him to do. It's just something that he's done because he's observed the way that I've lived and I guess become inspired by it and decided to make a change. And that, to me, is incredible.
And now you've turned this into a business.
I have, yes. I have recently, I just finished up my Kickstarter campaign for my new company, The Simply Co., which will sell organic vegan cleaning products. My first product is a 3-ingredient organic vegan laundry detergent. And it's the laundry detergent that I've been using since I started becoming zero waste.
And it works.
And it works.
I wouldn't imagine you would say anything else. When things like Oh, I guess many food items, particularly fresh food and produce, you can go in with your own packaging, essentially your own bag, and bring home as much as you want to. But there is no alternative to toothpaste. You can't go in and order a pound of toothpaste. Or can you? Is there the beginning of a market for people who want to buy things in bulk so that they can bring their own packages and walk away with just about as much as they want, to know more than that and no wrapping?
There are some companies that are actually popping up, and some stores, in fact, that are popping up that sell a lot of, you know, hard-to-find products such as, you know, laundry detergents and cleaning products. And I haven't seen toothpaste yet, but there are, you know, shampoos and conditioners available in bulk. And, you know, the toothpaste that I use, for instance, is so simple to make. It's just baking soda, coconut oil, and peppermint oil. So essentially, you could walk into a store, buy those ingredients, and for all intents and purposes, have the uncombined ingredients for toothpaste.
And which are the items that you're saying that are now available in bulk, like shampoo, for example? Was one?
Yeah,
you
can get shampoo in bulk, soap in bulk.
So do you go in with your own jar to buy that?
I do. Mm-hmm.
And it comes out of what, a barrel or something like that?
Yeah, everything from, you know, a little bin to a barrel to a larger jar, lots of different things.
So you need a lot of glass jars in your life to do this.
I am a mason jar addict.
I've never met a mason jar addict before.
I am happy to be the first.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about what individuals can do to help prevent climate change and to keep the environment cleaner, and you can join this conversation. What are you doing this holiday season to decrease your waste, and what does being green mean to you? We've been talking with Lauren Singer. She's a 23-year-old who has lived a zero-waste life for the past 2 years, producing almost no trash, and she runs a blog that documents these efforts called Trash Is for Tossers. I'd also like to bring into the conversation now two more voices. Joining us from New York is Andrew Revkin, who's a senior fellow at Pace University's Academy for Applied Environmental Studies, and he also runs the New York Times .Earth blog. Andrew Revkin, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
And also joining us here in the studio is John Rogers. He's a senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He was co-author of their book, Cooler, Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. John Rogers, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here, John.
Andrew Revkin, I want to go to you. As we mentioned at the beginning of the program, there's a big picture effort to reduce carbon emissions, and we're at the end of a two-week run of meetings, negotiations, and potential deal-making that's taking place in Lima, Peru. Not going swimmingly, just give us an update on what's going on there and what are the obstacles?
Well, there are big obstacles, but it all depends on the question. Europe and some developing countries still want to have a binding agreement, you know, like a legally binding treaty, an instrument where countries have to report and they'll be punished if they miss emissions targets. That's kind of the 20th century concept that's not going to work in a century with so much complexity in the world, where rising emissions are mainly coming from fast-growing countries, where energy is the dominant concern and climate is a very much secondary imperative at the political scale and in most people's lives. But at the same time, I wrote a piece a few days ago on .Earth about the encouraging thing, which is that the shift is going toward still progress, but it'll be more bottom up, which is kind of like what you were talking about earlier, but not from the person scale necessarily, but from the state and city and country scale. Mm. Each country doing what it can to move away from a carbon intensive energy system for the many reasons why that makes sense. Like in China, it's mostly about good old fashioned air pollution. That's their main concern with coal, not so much climate. So there's a lot going on.
All right. Well, since our focus is bottom up, I want to listen to something that we heard back in May from Niagara County, where the local NBC News affiliate there, WGRZ, was reporting that area's recycling program was not going very well. And one resident of North Tonawanda explained why she does not recycle.
I feel bad about that. And I wish I could recycle more, but I think it's, I don't know exactly the benefits that it's going to bring to my family exactly that would make a difference for me to recycle.
So John Rogers, from the Union of Concerned Scientists, you've written a book basically that tries to answer this resident's question. The bottom up, is there a clear-cut sort of roadmap for folks who want to do the right thing and who actually feel like, number one, they don't know, and number two, not actually really believing that they're a little bit would make a difference? Does a little bit make a difference?
Yeah, those are great questions, John. I'll say, the approach we took for the research we did that fed into the book Cooler, Smarter was to look at the carbon implications of all the hundreds of potential decisions we're making as consumers. So whether that's deciding what to eat or insulating your home or going to the doctor, to really try to figure out what does matter. So for the average person, where could you focus if you wanted to have the most impact? And it basically comes down to three things: what and how you drive, how you use energy at home, and what you eat, particularly how much red meat. Now, the remaining piece, sort of the last quarter, is sort of the stuff we very scientifically call stuff we buy. And that's the sort of stuff that and that certainly touches on what Lauren's talking about. And that's got some real opportunities. They're a little bit more nebulous, and some things are a little bit more out of our control. So it's really for the average person, you want to be looking at transportation, thinking about transportation, thinking about home energy use, and thinking about your eating habits.
Well, Lauren Singer, how are you doing on home energy use and driving?
I live in New York City, so I do not drive. I use my two legs or public transportation to get everywhere, so I think I'm pretty good on that one. And home energy use, I guess, lucky for the planet. I live in a little tiny apartment in Brooklyn, and so I use natural light pretty much all the time, except for the night where I use one or two lights. So I actually have a very low energy use, and I eat a predominantly raw diet. I eat lots of salads, so I don't have to cook very often either. So pretty low energy use.
Andrew Refkin, also sort of wondering where the rubber meets the road for you on this, since you know you're committed to the philosophy. How do you do on driving, eating, and energy use in your home?
Well, we do better now than we did as of 6 months ago. We just moved after 17 years living in a rural part of the Hudson River Valley to the village of Cold Spring, where it took me 5 minutes, well, 10 minutes to walk to the train and to come into the city. Trains are a very efficient way to move people. And my son now walks to school through 300 yards. Mm-hmm. And so that's all pretty transformative.
Did you move primarily for motivated by the energy footprint issue?
No, it's co-benefits. My son is just reaching driving age, and the less driving he does makes him a safer, have a safer lifestyle in it. So that's part of it too. Looking at co-benefits is definitely a keystone. That relates to things like flying. You'll hear about carbon offsets of various kinds. Can you pay for the sin of flying? And I think there are some resources online to look at if you want to do that. There's green-e.org is a place that sort of tracks the reliability of these carbon offset kind of things. It's still a very small part of the picture. But I think what was just said a minute ago by John and you, the two Johns, is key, that what we're moving toward increasingly, hopefully, is where we consider the implications of energy choices as a routine part of how we consider anything, whether it's a zoning plan in your local town or whether it's the composting, as you just heard, having a composting policy. I love that idea of the farmer's market being the sort of a nexus for dropping off stuff. I'm going to check with our local farmer's market in Cold Spring to see if we can do that, because it's hard to do it in a village or city setting to compost your stuff.
To that point, I received a tweet from Stephen Carmona Mora, who writes this. Actually, this was on our Facebook page. He writes, "You need a certain class standing to not produce waste. A simple analysis of no waste is universal does not do justice to people who can't afford to waste some money on a jar or who have a nearby farmer market." And I think it's clear what Stephen's saying, that if you're not particularly well off, it may be a lot harder, or it might sound a lot harder, to hit these targets. What about that, John Rogers?
So I think the way Lauren put it is great, that she talked about not preaching to her friends. I think if we look around for examples like Lauren, like Bea Johnson, who we profile Bea and her husband Scott in our book. You can find examples, I think, where we basically think wherever you are in your life, whether you're single and living in the city or have a big house, lots of kids and a big commute, wherever you are, there are opportunities. We talk in our book about the 20% challenge, cutting 20% in the near term, maybe in the next year, off your carbon. We think there are real opportunities. And you do that by finding examples, not adopting what other people are doing wholesale, but figuring out what works in your life. So maybe you can't do anything about you're not in a position to do anything about your transportation, but you can do anything. You're replacing your furnace anyway. Mm-hmm. As Andy says, if you're just making carbon part of the decision making when you are going to buy a new car, thinking not just about safety and carrying capacity, but thinking about fuel economy.
So it's not saying that if you live in the country, you need to move to a city.
Right. So do what's right for you. Look for opportunities, have carbon be part of the decision-making process.
Let's bring in some callers, and let's start with Jack from Edwards, New York. Jack, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, it's a pleasure. What do you have to say?
I've been living for the last 15 years in a cabin with no electricity, no running water. I do take my garbage to the waste transfer station, mm-hmm. but I've only taken two or three pickup trucks loads in the last 15 years. My carbon imprint is very, very small.
Sounds very, very small. Yeah.
I burn wood for heat, which is CO2 neutral, because if that wood rots in the woods, it gives off CO2. If you burn it, mm-hmm. it gives off the same amount of CO2. So my carbon imprint is very, very minimal. And
how are you talking to us now? I mean, did you drive into town and are you on a payphone or?
No, I have a cell phone.
How do you charge the cell phone?
I have a car charger.
Okay. What, John Rogers, what's your analysis? I'm sorry, go ahead, Andrew.
Oh, this is Andy, sorry. It's very creditable if you can do those things, as in the earlier segment on living a low-impact life here in a developed country. But one thing to keep in mind at the global scale is that something like 2 billion people still have to collect firewood or dung to cook their daily meals. Mm-hmm. One of the most jarring pieces I wrote for Dot Earth was when I interviewed a researcher at Stanford who spent time in the Himalayas in Nepal, and she witnessed a knife fight between two families over a pile of firewood that one of their kids had just brought out of the woods. And the reality is, for billions of people on the planet, they live under-energized lives. So it's fine for us to, I do think the earlier Twitter message about, I won't call it elitist, but there are two challenges here. There's the developed country challenge, and then at the global scale, the great way to put this, as the United Nations has put it, Ban Ki-moon has talked about what's called sustainable energy for all, which means some countries need more energy, and that even includes, in some cases, more fossil energy, even as we try to pursue lower carbon alternatives where we can afford to.
Let's bring in Rob from Williamsburg, Virginia. Rob, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I had a couple of questions. Number one, living in a city, one of the things I try to do is I try to recycle, reuse, reduce, recycle. And as far as I know, my products that I'm recycling are getting just reconverted back into, yes, more plastics, but they're being reused. The other thing is, I work in a lab where we radio label cellulose acetate, which is a plastic building block. And what we proved, and this was for the Navy, was that plastic silverware, the plasticware, I guess, it was completely compostable.
Oh, interesting.
The composting process down to an elemental level. And so, it would seem like if people are going to use it, that should become more available. One of the problems was the United States does not have a lot of municipal composting facilities.
All right, let me take that question back to our guests. Lauren Singer, as Rob was just saying, he believes in recycling, although everything comes back as plastic. And I'm just curious what your take is on recycling, since you don't like plastic, but it brings stuff back as plastic.
Sure. I don't really recycle that much because I don't have much to recycle. As Bea says, you know, the first step is refusing, and I refuse to buy things that are packaged anymore. So recycling is a really good alternative for things that, you know, are already existing, or a good alternative to throwing things out. But there was a really good study that came out yesterday by Marcus Erickson from Five Gyres, and it found that there's over 250,000 metric tons of plastic floating in the ocean and over 5.25 trillion plastic particles in the ocean. And that's just something that I don't feel like contributing to. And because I feel like there are good alternatives that are plastic-free, I choose to use those.
John Rogers, I want to talk a little bit more about, you've come up with a list. You kind of clumped everything together in three basic ways, but let's unpack that a little bit. Things that people can do right now that are really low cost and actually quite easy, like the temperature of the water they wash their clothes in.
Sure, right. Making decisions. So there are things that we want to decide when we're making big purchases, when we're buying a new car, when we're buying a new fridge or a new washing machine or furnace. There are other things we can do with what we've got now. So if you're talking about a car, you know, keeping that car tuned up, driving 65 instead of 75. Chaining trips together, so you're not going out, you know, just for a single errand, but doing multiple errands at once. When it comes to things around the house, you know, one of the things is, you know, washing in cold water. You know, studies have shown that this can be quite effective.
That's dead nailed that you can wash your clothes in cold water,
right?
And
you're
clean.
And you're saving a lot, depending on, you know, how you heat your water. But that could be a fine way to deal with most of your things. If you think about home energy use, light bulbs are low-hanging fruit. You know, lots of technology evolution in recent years cost much better than it used to be. Very cost effective. Things like a programmable thermostat. If you heat or cool your own home, installing one of those, if you don't have one, make sure it's programmed correctly. If you do have one, what we're really looking for, the reason we call our book Cooler Smarter, is because we're looking for opportunities that are good from a carbon perspective, but also can save you money or do good things for your carbon, but are also healthier. So if you think about Andy now walking to work, taking the train, all that, you think about his son walking to school. Those are good decisions. If you think about Lauren's probably eating much more healthily than the rest of us who go out and get fast food all the time. So there are lots of things we can do that are good from a carbon perspective and good, also smarter from other perspectives.
The other thing, you've mentioned it without mentioning it directly, but a lot of this stuff will save money for the individual.
Right, right.
Cold water versus hot water.
Right. The light bulbs will pay for themselves very quickly. If you buy a more efficient car, if you go from a car that gets 20 miles per gallon the next time you're out shopping and buy one that gets 40 miles per gallon, you could be saving something like $18,000.
Really?
Over the course of the life of that car. So, you know, there are real opportunities to make decisions that are good for the planet and good for your pocketbook.
Well, Lauren Singer, Andrew Refkin, John Rogers, please stay with us. We are discussing ways to be greener. And we're going out of this segment with a song by one of our guests today. This is actually Andrew Refkin, who, besides his job as an environmental reporter and expert, is also an accomplished musician. A longtime accompanist to Pete Seeger. He just released his own first album. Here is a track from it. It is called Liberated Carbon. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
Now I got peat swamp fossils running my TV. BP's black label burns in my SUV. We can light up the planet like a Christmas tree. Yeah, they say that things are getting hot, but hey, we've got AC. Liberated carbon, it'll spin your wheels.
This is On Point. I'm John Donovan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the small steps that each of us can take to be greener, and you can join in this conversation. Do you compost? Do you buy carbon offsets? Do you give money to environmental charities? Do you think that these are the most effective ways to help the environment. We're talking with Lauren Singer. She's a 23-year-old who has lived a zero-waste life for the last 2 years, producing almost no trash. And she runs a blog you can check out called Trash is for Tossers, where she documents her efforts. Also with Andrew Refkin, he's a senior fellow at Pace University's Academy for Applied Environmental Studies and runs the New York Times .Earth blog. And John Rogers, a senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists and co-author of their book, Cooler, Smarter, Practical Steps for Lower Carbon Living. And I want to take to Andrew Refkin the question of how sometimes we can get mixed messages about whether a particular step taken in an effort to be more environmentally conscious is the correct one or not. And sometimes we'll find out, for example, that electric cars are a good choice because they don't burn fossil fuels, but they're a bad choice because the electricity that's used to power them comes from power plants that are burning fossil fuels, and that therefore it may not even be a net plus, but could also be a net negative. Or another example would be the whole controversy over disposable diapers versus cloth diapers. Obviously, disposable diapers put plastic into the system, into the landfills, but the cloth diapers require an awful lot of water, which can be a challenge, particularly in some parts of the country. Are these issues settled? Do we always know ultimately what the arithmetic is on any particular step that you take?
Oh, no, it's really hard. And some of our choices, I think one of the best ways to navigate this is to be sure you're clear about your own – where your values want you to go. We've heard about farmers markets. In the Hudson Valley, I love shopping at our farmers market, but it's mostly not because of carbon. And if I was doing it because of carbon, I'd be making a mistake. I could explain that in a second. But it's because I value having farming remain a part of the regional economy and landscape. There were studies done that showed that essentially industrial scale strawberry farming is more energy efficient than buying strawberries from your local farmer's market, because there's so many more trips that have to be taken and small trucks to take strawberries here and there and that kind of thing. So and there's no way you can keep track of that. Full life cycle analysis is the phrase to always Google for whatever it is, whether it's agriculture or some other choice. Looking at the full life cycle of a battery, you know, how much energy went into making the battery, how long does it take for that energy to be that investment of energy as well as dollars to be paid for is really they're interesting questions. But I think in the long run, you have to back off a little bit and say, you know, why do I want to shop at a farmer's market, or what do I want in my food? Or I think saving money on energy, you know, we just moved into a 130-year-old house that has a lot of energy challenges, and I look forward to the coming years to cutting it, just because I have an interest in both saving money and cutting my environmental impact. But it really is a both thing.
And Lauren Singer, to the same point that sometimes it's not clear what's actually the more environmentally beneficial choice. Do you ever find people pushing back against the choices you make, not for philosophical reasons, but more for the scientific reasons, or do you feel you're on pretty solid ground?
I get some criticisms, but that's mostly because people don't understand how some of the processes work, you know, even industrial processes like wastewater treatment, for instance. And, you know, I agree with Andrew that you just have to kind of figure out what your goals are. For me, my goals are lessening my environmental impact by way of reducing trash. And so as far as achieving that goal, I have and so, you know, I'm not going to look at the life cycle analysis of every single action that I take. But as far as not making any trash and putting anything into landfill, I've achieved that. So, you know, I don't think there's very much to criticize.
Let's go to Celeste from Austin, Texas. Celeste, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I think that Lauren she's an inspiration. And I mean, at least to me, it seems kind of daunting, I think, when I think about all the steps that she's taken, the things that she's done. But I just wanted to share like one really small step that I took about 15 years ago that has made a really big difference in my life, is that I just started carrying a travel mug with me, which sounds like something so simple. And it is so simple, and it just saves, I realized like how many paper cups, to-go cups people use constantly, like several every single day, it seems like most people I know. And the cool thing is that at most places they'll give you a discount, or a lot of times they won't even charge you at all if you're, you know, getting something like, you know, soda or whatever at a convenience store. The cup costs more than the contents, and so a lot of times you'll get it for free, or you'll at least get, you know, a 5 to 25 cent discount.
How many years?
So there's one way to save money.
How many years have you been doing that with the cup?
About 15.
So 15 years, let's
and
say.
I almost never forget it. It's just habit now, like car keys or something. I just grab it every time I leave the house.
And it's a daily thing for you, business day. So
yeah.
200 times a year, so that's 3,000 times that you haven't bought a paper cup. I want to take that to John Rogers. Is that a big deal? Or is that a tiny, tiny, tiny drop in the bucket that didn't change very much except in Celeste's own life?
Well, I think there are two components. One is the cup she's saving, and one is the sort of ethic that she is developing, has developed, that she is maybe inspiring in other people. I think part of what you want to do is challenge yourself, and Lauren has certainly done that with what she's done, and Andy's done that now with his new house, and you know, sort of laid down the gauntlet. You want to challenge yourself. You want to be empowered, and part of being empowered is trying to understand what matters and why. So if you look at the numbers, as we at the Union of Concerned Scientists do, let's go back to the example of electric vehicles. Well, it turns out that even in the dirtiest parts of the country, yes, that power has to come from you're getting electricity. Even in the dirtiest parts of the country, you're talking about a car that gets upwards of 30, close to 40 miles per gallon, the equivalent in terms of the emissions. So if you're empowered with what matters in your life and empowered with how you can make a difference, then you make different decisions. And I think the third step is inspiring, and that's what we're hearing today, is people who were inspired, who are inspiring other people to think a little different. Think, do I really need that cup? Can I do it differently? Can I bring my own travel mug? Do I need all that plastic? So challenging, empowering, inspiring, I think, gets us to a much better place.
And Celeste may have just done that for listeners, particularly hearing it was easy, it's become a habit, and she's getting a discount. I'm betting today she won a few converts to the Bring Your Own Cup.
I think that's right. I think, you know, and part of that is helping people see this as an opportunity. So if she's saving money, that's great. But really just thinking about an opportunity, not thinking about it as something you have to do, but something as you can do. There are clearly things that have to happen at the, you know, we go back to the talks in Lima, or what our federal government needs to be doing, what Congress needs to be doing, what our state level. But that from our perspective, there are so many things that are opportunities that should be thought of as opportunities, not as things we have to do, but as things we can do.
Let's bring in Ramey from Jamestown, Kentucky. Ramey, welcome to On Point.
Hi John.
Hi.
My comment basically is I live in rural Kentucky, basically a large farming town, but where there also seems to be a huge disconnect where fossil fuels aren't tied into actual, that they're almost viewed as a renewable resource or just an infinite resource. And it's the same with recycling and waste. There doesn't seem to be any direct consequence to people using the energy they do. I recycle, and I've taught my son to, and try to tell as many people about it. But my question is, how do you bridge that gap? And what do you do as far as education and someone who is just a normal community member? How do you tie that in and get involved to get people to realize that, you know, gas, natural gas, oil, even though their natural gas is great, that it's not going to be around forever? How do you get people aware of that and solve that problem?
Ramey, can I ask you a question before we go to the guest? You know, we were talking before with Lauren Singer. She says she never preaches to anybody because nobody wants to hear it. Are you in that situation where you feel that you're the guy who gets it and you want to share it and nobody wants to hear it? Or do you kind of play it cool in that regard?
I've tried that, but what I do is basically just try to show people. I helped implement a program at my office of about 50 people to start recycling. Our county does not have recycle pickup. You actually have to take it to a trailer somewhere located in the county. So there's a little bit of responsibility there, and I think that's something that people are so detached from where their waste goes that it's easy to just, you know, let the man take it to the landfill.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I make the little bit of an extra effort, the extra five steps to recycle. And sometimes that's viewed as kind of weird, you know, because it's not as easily accessible.
And the other thing I'm curious about, does a large part of the community, I mean, you're in Kentucky, you know, it's coal country, it's fracking country. Does the community depend on those industries for jobs? And is that one of the reasons perhaps that you're not...
Ours actually doesn't. Ours is actually very high hydropower. We're on Lake Cumberland, and we have Wolf Creek Dam right in our community, and a lot of that hydropower actually goes to Tennessee, though. But no, we're not really affected by, you know, there's no coal jobs here or anything. But
all right, let's take it then to Andrew Revkin to sort of answer your question. How does he have that conversation with his own community?
Well, this is the arena. You know, I'm a journalist, but I'm also now in academia the last 5 years and at Pace. And I write a lot about the opportunities for education, both at the community level through what he's just talking about, using social media, Twitter and Facebook, to in a non-preachy way to sort of spread good ideas, including, hey, you know, there's a way to do the recycling pickup that's easier, something like that. But at the education level, that's where I'm so juiced, whether it's students on Pace's campus this year, they're doing an energy initiative all year, both within the curriculum and, you know, on the campus. There's a school in New York. 2 years ago, I said I gave a lecture and I said, hey, you know, wouldn't it be great if the one thing I could see in academia that would be really cool would be if we did like a field trip, but not going anywhere, going to the boiler room of the school. And then someone tweeted to me from Solar One, a group in New York City that works with on curricula on energy. They said, we're already doing that. And there's a high school in the Bronx, public high school, where students go on a boiler room tour. They learn where their energy comes from. They learn how a boiler works. They learn about oil dependency. And no one's preaching to them. It's just something they see. And that's about the connections. You know, he mentioned how people don't know where their waste comes from. Gunnery school, a private school years ago, abandoned trays in their cafeteria. And students, guess what? There's less waste. They take less food. That's just so cool.
We've had a lot of tweets coming in on this one, and this one I think is intended for you, Lawrence Singer. Karen Jeffers Tracy asks on Twitter, what can I put my purchases in at the grocery store? Waxed paper? How do you do it? I'm imagining she's talking about getting a piece of meat that's not going to be wrapped in plastic. So, and I guess she's imagining that it's sort of slapped into your hand. How do you get it home?
Those are great questions. I am actually a vegetarian, but if I were to go to the market, for instance, and buy something like meat, you can bring like a glass container and actually have your butcher take the tare, which is pre-weighing the weight of the container, and then putting something like the meat inside of it and then weighing it, and then they can actually price it for you. So that's how something like that would work. For other things like bulk products, rice, grains, beans, or any kind of vegetables, loose vegetables, I'll bring mason jars to put it in. Again, you have to tear them first. Or I'll use organic cotton sacks. Or, you know, you can even use an old pillowcase to fill with bulk products. So that's the easiest way to do it. And then I carry them all home in a reusable bag.
This negotiation with the butcher, is this a difficult conversation? Please take this glass case I've brought in and please subtract the weight and then add it all up. First time, I know you're saying that you don't need meat, but you know, I'm sure you've done the equivalent in other areas.
Yeah.
Fish, let's say, even if you're not eating fish. Is it a difficult conversation?
No, not at all. You know, taking the tare is something that someone that works behind a meat counter or a cheese counter or something, they're completely used to. And actually, I've found that more often than not, it sparks really interesting conversation. And those people really align with what I'm doing and they really like it. You know, and that's also a really good opportunity for education, as we were talking about before. Every time you do something like bring your own container, for instance, to a coffee shop, it's a really good opportunity to have someone ask you a question. Why do you do this? And to explain in a really casual, comfortable way. And then you can do something like inspire someone to take the next step. And you never know. You might even get a free coffee.
Well, we've heard that you can get that. Let's bring in Hillary from Urbana, Ohio. Hillary, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
It's such a privilege to talk to you. I just wanted to, I guess, piggyback off of the comment that was made a minute ago about the man who's from rural Kentucky. I'm from a small town in rural Ohio, and just the other day I went with my mother to the grocery, and she always gets plastic bags just out of convenience and because it's what we always do. And I encouraged her to take my reusable bags the other day to the store, and surprisingly, she found it was a lot easier because there were less bags to carry and they were sturdier and you could put more stuff in them. And I think it's interesting to see how, for me, like the younger generation and the older generation, especially in rural areas across the United States, have different viewpoints on things. And honestly, I think to some degree, just because it's such a cultural thing and people revert back to what they've grown up with and what they know, I think it'll be interesting to see how policy changes can really affect change down to the cultural level. Like California's plastic bag recent law, as well as like different bottle bills and everything, I think to some degree, although education is really beneficial, I think it's going to take policy change to encourage people that haven't grown up with more environmentally conscious, I guess, education.
Hillary, I'm going to have to cut you off because we're hitting our time limit, but you actually gave us a perfect wrap-up for the hour, tying everything together, the personal and the systemic and the political and the practical. Thank you so much for doing that. Lauren Singer has lived a zero-waste life for these last 2 years, producing almost no trash. Thank you, Lauren, for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrew Rethkin, senior fellow at Pace University's Academy for Applied Environmental Studies, runs the New York Times .earth blog. Thank you, Andrew.
Great to be with you.
And John Rogers, a senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists, co-author of the book Cooler, Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
You can continue the conversation at get our On Point podcast, and you can follow us on Twitter. Coming up tomorrow, why there are more chickens than people in the world, the remarkable story of what happened when the chicken crossed the road and the world. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.